It's Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an American historian tells us why some Bernie Sanders supporters might switch to Team Donald Trump if Hillary Clinton gets the Democratic nomination.
First, a new U.S. Senate report out this week comes to some troubling conclusions about how a Veterans Affairs watchdog agency handled an investigation into the Tomah VA hospital and the overprescription of opioids to veterans there.
The Senate report found that the Office of Inspector General, which is charged with independently investigating VA complaints, discounted key evidence and witness testimony, needlessly narrowed its inquiry, and has no standard for determining wrongdoing. While the report focuses on Tomah, it does raise new questions about the agency's ability to properly oversee care of veterans across the nation.
Here with us now to discuss the investigation is Donovan Slack. She's a reporter at USA Today's Washington Bureau. She's been following the Tomah story for some time now. Donovan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this Senate investigation, what were they focusing on here?
When they started it, they were really just looking at Tomah and how the problems there could have carried on for so long. But then the committee quickly started focusing on the Inspector General's office, because the Inspector General spent 2 years looking at care and how it was being delivered in Tomah, and yet still didn't find any wrongdoing.
As we've talked to you about in the past, a lot of the focus over the last year or two has been on the people, the staff at Tomah, who were over-prescribing opioids, things like that. This is going beyond that now. Talk about this Inspector General office. An agency's Inspector General, their job, I guess, is to find problems, diagnose them, and offer a road to getting better. It sounds like the Inspector General for the VA fell way short on that.
In this case, that's certainly what the Senate committee concluded, and obviously there is evidence in the report to back that up. Each federal agency has an inspector general, and under federal law, they're supposed to be independent, objective watchdogs who, you know, take in complaints of wrongdoing, whether it's money that's being misspent or, in this case, poor care being given to veterans. And then they're supposed to investigate what went wrong, and confirm whether it was in fact done improperly, and then, of course, as you say, make recommendations for improvement.
Let's get into some of the specific criticisms that came from this Senate panel. One of them, they criticized the Inspector General's decision not to release an investigation report. Now, this is a report that was done before all of this came out into the public eye, before there was a death related to prescriptions there. What do we know about this report and why the Inspector General didn't release it to the public?
Well, this is one of the most interesting things, I think, that the Senate committee came up with, is they were able to pinpoint the Inspector General official that made that decision, a man by the name of Dr. John Day, and they interviewed him and asked him, you know, why would you keep this from the public? Because the report did, in fact, say that there was a concerning number of prescriptions being handed out. And he said that he felt that releasing the report would, quote, destroy the small community of Tomah and the reputation of its VA.
And I imagine the Senate was not happy about that. I mean, obviously the reputation has been destroyed since then, far worse than it would have been had that report come out then. Did the Senate issue any kind of, this panel issue, findings on that or a response to that statement?
Oh, well, I mean, the Senate panel found failure after failure, and I think they named this failure one of the biggest, which was keeping that report secret.
And you also write that the investigation found that the Inspector General's office downplayed some key evidence, some witness testimony, narrowed its inquiry too much, didn't go out looking for the wider scope of the problems. How did that play out, according to what this panel found?
Well, here's an interesting example in that category. And in the Inspector General's office, someone was reviewing patient charts of the patients at Tomah, and they actually wrote in their notes, hey, there's a lot of polypharmacy going on here. Would love to have a pharmacist look at this. Well, they never did. And the reason is because that was, quote, outside the scope of their investigation. What they were looking at is how many opioids were being prescribed. But what they didn't look at was opioids being prescribed in dangerous combinations with other drugs. And that's what this employee was flagging, the polypharmacy. And that was later found to be rampant and very dangerous.
Talking to Donovan Slack from USA Today about a new Senate panel report out on the ongoing Thoma VA scandal. A lot of attention focused here on the VA's Office of the Inspector General. Another critique that came out of the Inspector General is they had this investigation going, a narrow scope to it, and also when they had data, no real way to assess wrongdoing, no way to decide what was wrong, what needed to be done to fix it.
Well, the interesting thing here is they didn't appear to have a standard, meaning at the end of this whole thing, they just sit down as a committee and discuss, oh, well, that looks like, you know, we have enough on this count to find wrongdoing, or on this count we don't. But that system leaves it a very subjective system. So that means that the decisions are different, different based on locality or whoever's making the decision. So what the Senate panel pinpointed was the lack of a standard.
And looking back at all these things that weren't brought to the public eye, changes not made in polypharmacy, prescribing multiple medications, possibly in dangerous combinations, figuring out if things were being done wrong, all this, looking back in hindsight, could have prevented at least one death, probably, and a lot of other problems that have come to be associated with Thoma. So given that, what's happening now? Is there a sense that the Office of the Inspector General is trying harder at Thoma and elsewhere to fix the problems that they didn't fix previously?
Well, they are certainly saying so. There is a new Inspector General in charge of the office. He was just sworn in last month, and he is promising greater transparency and other improvements to the office. The doctor who made the call to keep the Thoma report secret, he is still in place, and he is still in charge of healthcare investigations. It remains to be seen what will change there.
We've been focusing on the Office of the Inspector General, and that's what a lot of the report did. That's not the only point of blame here. Other agencies also were noted as ones that could have made a difference had they acted earlier. Who else was included in that?
Right, and they singled out the local police, I think the local sheriff's department, the DEA, and the FBI, and of course the VA itself. But they singled out the Inspector General's office, they said, because there will always be problems in an agency of this size, and that means that you must have a strong watchdog like the Inspector General.
What do we know about what's happening at Thoma in particular now? Are we through the woods? Are we still figuring out what went wrong and what might still be going wrong?
Well, I mean, there was a hearing out there this morning, as you know, and the undersecretary for the VA testified, and he talked about a lot of the programs and things that they're putting in place there, and they're saying there's a lot of improvements. I think it remains to be seen. The report is, the jury is still out, if you will.
Another question I have, and I didn't see whether this was included in this Senate panel report, there were a lot of efforts by whistleblowers at one stage of the process or another to try to bring attention to this issue. Was there any talk in this Senate panel report about how whistleblowers are treated and listened to?
Yes. There were some findings. I think you may be familiar. There is a gentleman named Ryan Honal, who is a former Thoma employee, and he tried to shed light on this issue. He was retaliated against. A pharmacist, Noelle Johnson, tried to bring concerns actually back in 2009, I believe, and she was actually fired. There was another employee who tragically committed suicide. He was disciplined for questioning the prescription amounts, and the list just goes on and on.
Donovan, I got to ask, these problems are specific to Thoma, but we've heard a lot about waiting times at other VA facilities around the country. Have we heard anything about similar overprescription of opioid medication at VA facilities apart from Thoma?
Well, Thoma is unfortunately, it has become something of the trophy, signifying picture of what's going wrong elsewhere. It is, I think, the worst that we have found. But because of Thoma, the VA has started implementing programs across the country to try and limit opiate addiction and prescription.
Donovan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
No problem. Have a great day.
That's Donovan Slack. She's a reporter at USA Today's Washington Bureau. She joined us to talk about a U.S. Senate panel report into how the VA Office of Inspector General mishandled, the panel says, their investigation into Tomah's VA hospital. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest says politics are being driven by fear and anger, even amid some good news about the overall direction of the country and the economy.
Right now, we're talking presidential politics and taking a closer look at two sides of what might be the same anti-establishment coin.
With Donald Trump as the likely Republican nominee, it seems like the populist right got their wish, but the same probably can't be said for the populist left, with longtime politician and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as frontrunner on the Democratic side.
While many experts have said supporters of Trump and supporters of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders are just too ideologically different, our next guest says that their mistrust of career politicians might be enough to bring the two sides together in this presidential election.
Joining us now is Josh Zietz. He's taught American history and politics at Cambridge University and Princeton University. His article, Why Bernie's Bros Might Go for Trump, recently appeared in Politico magazine. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm going to start with a line from your piece. You say the historical lesson for Hillary Clinton is clear. Watch the left flank because it could very well swing to the right. So in general, what do you see when you look at the situation now compared to some other races you've looked at in the past?
Sure. I would caution against assuming that history always repeats itself. But in Politico, I wrote about two races that had offer some precedent for 2016. The first was in 1968. When Eugene McCarthy, a very liberal senator from Minnesota, ran for president against Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy in the Democratic primaries. And then in 1980, when Edward Kennedy, a very liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, challenged incumbent President Jimmy Carter. And in both of those cases, liberal insurgent candidates, McCarthy and Kennedy, captured a popular revulsion, with establishment politics and establishment institutions. Neither was successful in capturing the party's nomination. But interestingly enough, a fairly sizable number of each candidate's primary electorate support swung to right-wing candidates in the general election. So in 1968, roughly 18% of Eugene McCarthy's voters ended up supporting right-wing candidate George Wallace, who was running as a third-party candidate at the time for president. And in 1980, 27% of Edward Kennedy's primary voters ended up supporting Ronald Reagan in the general election. And I think what historians will tell you is that there was a lot less ideology and a lot more anger and despair and protest driving some of the support for these insurgent candidates. The same could very well be true in 2016 of Bernie Sanders' support.
How crucial were those votes that swung the other direction to who eventually won the presidential race, not the nomination, but the president?
Sure. In 1980, it was probably not instrumental in as much as Jimmy Carter lost by a fairly sizable margin to Ronald Reagan. But in 1968, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, a very liberal Democrat who was running as the party's candidate against Richard Nixon in the general election, he lost to Nixon by just a slither. I mean, he lost by roughly 50,000 votes. And the number of McCarthy voters who swung over to Wallace was much larger than that. Now, it's unclear whether they were in the right states, whereby they might have swung the Electoral College to Hubert Humphrey. But it seems probable that had had McCarthy voters ended up closing ranks behind Humphrey, which would have made sense, Humphrey could very well have pulled off that election. And what's remarkable is that both Humphrey and McCarthy were liberal Democrats who represented the same state, Minnesota, in the Senate. George Wallace was a right-wing, pro-segregation, ardently pro-Vietnam War protest candidate, and yet he captured, almost 20% of McCarthy's primary voters, which tells you that they weren't necessarily supporting Gene McCarthy because they were very liberal in disposition. They were supporting him because at the time he offered the only protest outlet against the incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson, who he forced out of the race.
So looking at Eugene McCarthy, he began, you write, as sort of a tepid candidate. The support for him wasn't there. He himself seemed to only think he'd be adequate. was there a sea change? What was it that shifted people to him and then his support later on in a, yet another direction?
Sure. I mean, McCarthy really was sort of like the fifth or sixth choice of the anti-war camp. They tried a number of other senators, including Robert Kennedy, including George McGovern, none of whom agreed to get into the race. And so finally, McCarthy agreed to challenge Johnson in the New Hampshire primary. He ran a lackadaisical primary campaign. He refused to get out early in the morning and shake hands at factory gates, at one point saying that he was not a quote-unquote morning person. But he ultimately surprised everyone by pulling 42% of the vote to Johnson's 49%, and by a quirk of the system, ended up getting more delegates in New Hampshire, which led Johnson to pull out of the race. Now, weeks later, Robert Kennedy got into the race. But I think McCarthy at that point actually believed that he could win the nomination, and many other people did at the time as well. So he began to run a much harder race.
We're talking right now with Josh Zeitz. He's taught American history and politics at Cambridge University and Princeton. And we're talking about his political article. It's called Why Bernie's Bros Might Go for Trump. And Josh, what similarities do you see between those two scenarios that you just ran us through and where the country is today in terms of its political climate?
Sure. You know, in 1968, exit polls found that a large number of McCarthy voters were not actually anti-war per se. Over 50% of them supported bombing in North Vietnam. And a sizable portion of those New Hampshire voters for McCarthy were actually supporting McCarthy because it was the only way to protest, cast a protest vote against Lyndon Johnson, whom some of them actually viewed as being too tepid on the war. What that ultimately tells us is that, you know, McCarthy was attracting a lot of voters who didn't necessarily align with his liberal agenda, but who were using him to voice their dissent, their dissatisfaction with establishment institutions and politicians. You know, by the same token, Bernie Sanders is certainly animating a number of supporters who actually agree with his politics. But polls have also found that that Hillary Clinton's supporters are actually more supportive of the Sanders legislative agenda than Sanders voters, which is a peculiar thing. And it's quite possible that many of the voters whom he's called to action, particularly those who aren't affiliated with the Democratic Party or who weren't before his candidacy, aren't necessarily liberal Democrats, but rather anti-establishment voters. And this fall, if they look at their choices and they see Hillary Clinton, who in every which way, good and bad, represents and embodies the establishment, they may not ultimately be able to pull the lever for her, because ultimately they may be driven more by anti-establishment sentiment than a liberal policy agenda.
And yet you said we shouldn't, you know, go to the bank on this, that history doesn't always repeat itself and you line up the parallels. Why are you being a little cautious?
Well, you just don't know. This is a much different country than it was in 1968 or 1980. It's less white. It's more diverse. Donald Trump has certainly alienated a large portion of the electorate, particularly women and Latinos. So it may not be as easy for him to attract a critical mass of Bernie Sanders supporters, although Sanders' support has been unusually white in its composition. That having been said, I think if there's a takeaway here, it's that in 1968, Eugene McCarthy didn't stump very hard for Hubert Humphrey. He did it in a fairly sort of begrudging way. In 1980, Edward Kennedy did ultimately fall in line behind Carter. I think that if there's a lesson for Hillary Clinton, it's that she's really going to need to enlist Bernie Sanders personally in an effort to persuade his voters to get out and support Hillary Clinton. And they're going to have to figure out how they communicate that message to voters who are pretty averse to an establishment candidate, no less so than McCarthy voters in 1968 or Kennedy voters in 1980.
If you look at Sanders supporters right now and Clinton supporters, and as well as the candidates themselves, it seems like there is growing acrimony between the two. Did you see that looking to those examples from the past? And how do you think that could play out if they seem really not to like each other?
Well, I think in 1980 there was a great deal of acrimony between Kennedy and Carter personally, and Carter and Kennedy supporters actually were pretty averse to Carter, generally speaking. A lot of Kennedy voters also broke for a third-party candidate, John Anderson, who was a very liberal Republican congressman who ultimately attracted a fair number of Kennedy voters, whereas Reagan captured about 27%. But I don't think that this is necessarily an indication of something that's set in stone. Remember, in 2008, 2008, there was a great deal of acrimony between Hillary Clinton supporters and the Barack Obama campaign, and a lot of people were predicting that her voters would not ultimately back then Senator Obama, but Hillary Clinton stumped hard for Obama, and as things began to close, and as you got closer to November, you saw more of her supporters moving into Obama's camp. You saw the same thing in 1968 as well. Far larger numbers of former McCarthy voters and Democrats generally were backing George Wallace in polling by the early fall, but organized labor got out and did an extremely aggressive push with its membership in September and October of 68 and reminded them that George Wallace presided over a strongly right-to-work anti-union state, that is Alabama, and that their interests lie with the Democratic Party. And ultimately, they were able to really reduce the damage that Wallace's candidacy might have done. Not enough, but they were able to reduce it. So these things do tend to close as you get closer to the election.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That was Josh Zietz. He's taught American history and politics at Cambridge University and Princeton. And he was talking with us there about his article in Politico. It's called Why Bernie's Bros Might Go for Trump.
Coming up after the news, even though we've seen long-term declines in crime and a gradual economic recovery, many people are worried about the future direction of the country. Our guest looks at the impact of fear and anger in American politics. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Last week, Google released the words each state misspells the most, and we want to hear from you about the words you trip up on the most. You can leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email us at talk@WPR.org.
First, a lot of this year's presidential campaign has been driven by anger at the party establishments, about the other political party among supporters of candidates in the same party, and about the direction the country is headed in with fears of crime, terrorism, and an uncertain economy.
Our next guest is most worried about that anger. He says that in many ways, things have been getting better in the United States. Crime is down, the economy is gradually improving, but anger has become a self-sustaining trend.
Richard Keit joins us now. He's a professor and director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. His piece on anger and politics appeared in the La Crosse Tribune. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Well, this is a huge question. What are people angry about this year?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, if you ask people what they're angry about, it's a whole range of things. I mentioned some of those in the column a couple of weeks ago: immigration, terrorism, political correctness, globalization, taxes, education. There's a whole realm. The frustrating thing is when you take those things one at a time and you look at what is actually going on. Sometimes even if you point out, say that, but we're actually doing well in that sort of thing, or this is the sort of thing that, say, politicians can't really offer a solution to, it's a different kind of problem, then the anger doesn't dissipate, right? So there's something driving the anger that is not necessarily what's actually going on in the country. There's a disconnect there.
Yeah, you point out in particular in your piece the crime rate going down, violent crime way down compared to a couple decades ago. The economy not magically great, but improving since the Great Recession. So that's some of the reality. But you say in some cases it's the perception of the state of the country that's more important.
Well, anger is a kind of a self-sustaining emotion in many ways. It can be contagious. So if somebody gets angry at you, you are likely to get angry in return, even if you're not sure what they're angry about. And this thing can take shape in populations as well. And I'm not trying to say there aren't legitimate things for people to be angry about. There's always a number of things to be angry or frustrated with. And yet I wonder if partly what's going on is we're hearing so much about anger that that in itself becomes a source of frustration with politics.
I wonder where it's coming from originally, and it may be a chicken or egg question. Is the populace at large angry? Is the way our media online, on the radio, elsewhere, presents stories drive that anger? Is it from political leaders? Where do you see a lot of the responsibility for this anger coming from?
I suspect that it's a real easy way to motivate people quickly, and so even if you're a politician and you want voters to turn out, it's much easier to get them to turn out by becoming angry about something. So you motivate the base, right? You get them angry, and so what you do is you tend to exaggerate some wrong that's taking place. By stressing how bad this is currently or how bad it could be. You exaggerate what the other side has said about it. And when you do this over and over and over, you tend to get a picture that things are really falling apart. After all, the people that I'm listening to keep telling us that, you know, this is a real crisis. And so I think partly it's our politicians that this is anger becomes a mode of campaigning. And then I think it's also our media. You get people tuning in to programs that are exaggerating the significance of something, rather than just, say, reporting some good stories. And so I think there's a number of things going on here.
Talking to Richard Kite from Viterbo University in La Crosse about anger and politics. So, Richard, let's talk about a political leader. You write, and you just pointed out, it can be an effective way to rally people to try to play off of and exacerbate the anger. But I could see a politician saying, I'm reflecting the anger. I'm reflecting the emotions that are out there. I am, as a representative of the people, representing their anger. Is that good leadership, or is there a better way to deal with public anger?
I think recognizing and acknowledging anger is important, but when we're electing politicians, we're electing leaders. And although you can motivate people to act through anger, anger is never an effective leadership tool because it inhibits people's judgment. People never think clearly when they're angry. And so if you want to be an effective leader, you motivate people in other means. You get them to think about a future, a direction to go. And so anger is useful. It's a kind of a useful short-term strategy for motivating, but it's not a good leadership tool.
I want to name some names here, and I want to start on the Republican side of this presidential race. Donald Trump, obviously expressing anger, and people are taking that and running with it, and now he is the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. How did you see anger playing out in the last bunch of months on the Republican side?
I think what we've just seen is it's become really effective, and it's certainly resonating. I'm not sure how much it... 1 year ago, when we were talking at the earlier parts of the primaries, if we thought that anger was the emotion that characterized the voting public, it certainly is what we would say is one of the main motivators right now. I don't think that's a result of the changing conditions in the Republic. I think that is a result of campaign strategy and what's turned out to be very effective.
What do you see as the long-term impact of that? Say, under a presidency run by someone who ran on reflecting and maybe channeling that public anger, what does that mean for policy?
Well, it means that we don't really pay attention to policy. When you're angry, you don't use good judgment. You don't really think clearly. And what happens, you know, individually, we've all experienced this. When we get really angry about something, we do something that's rash, and then we come to regret it when we think more clearly. And we think, well, what should we have done? And so when we're the voting public responsible for choosing a leader, we have to take that into account. So I don't see a good result of this, but I'd be surprised if anger is sustained over the next several months. I'm not sure how long it can be sustained as a political motivator. It'll be interesting to see.
On the Democratic side, there's been anger expressed, especially by Senator Bernie Sanders, toward Wall Street, and a lot of people picking up on that. But it seems like the main story of anger and politics on the Democratic side is between the two remaining candidates and more so their supporters. How do you see that playing out? What do you make of that?
Well, you see, within the Democratic Party, I think you see a lot of people shaking their heads and saying, why is the party trying to self-destruct, fighting itself like this? But again, this is exactly the sort of thing that happens when people get angry with one another, that there's we don't have a clearly rational end to be achieved. One of the things that I talk about in the column is anger as an emotion looks backward, not forward. And so as it seems like as the primary campaign is winding down, people are becoming more angry because they're focusing on grievances from weeks or months ago.
Now, you work with people who are leaders at various levels, I think at business, communities, things like that.
Right.
How do you counsel people to take that starting point, maybe, where there's this rising feedback loop of anger, and set that aside and find a more productive way to lead and to bring people along, people who are caught up in that anger themselves?
Well, one thing I do is just try to take the election part out of context and say, in general, what do you look for in a good leader? What do you look for? For example, who is a good corporate leader? We've all got all kinds of studies, Jim Collins' study, Good to Great, where he talks about level five leaders. These tend to be fairly quiet, introspective people who don't draw attention to themselves, but they really focus on how they can make other people better, how they can select good people for the right positions and encourage them. And then I ask, if this is what we look for in well-run businesses, why aren't we looking for it in a national leader? And so I just try to take the discussion out of the context that we usually put politics in its own category, right? I just try to take it out of that little narrow focus and say, well, how do we talk about leadership in general? Most people can pick out a good leader when they see one.
Richard, when you say quiet and introspective as a quality of a good leader, I can't imagine that lasting more than a couple days on the campaign trail in the primary as it exists today.
Well, and this is one of the problems. We have a campaign system that really favors getting high-level exposure on national media first. And the traits you need for that are pretty much the opposite of what you need for becoming a really effective leader and becoming experienced on the local level and then building your way up. And what we find is the best corporate leaders are people that really don't like to draw attention to themselves. So many of the top companies, they have leaders that you wouldn't recognize their faces or their names because they don't like the spotlight. And so this raises a real interesting question for American politics is, do we have a really flawed system for electing our leaders in the first place? Is that, and are we really seeing that come to play now in this election in particular?
We're talking about anger and American politics with Richard Kite from Viterbo University in La Crosse. He says angry talk, angry feelings do not lead to good policy, and good leaders need to be able to dial down the anger.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think this has been a particularly angry election year? And where do you think the anger is coming from? Do you feel it? Do you agree with our guests that we should be concerned about all this anger and how it could shape politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we continue our conversation now with Richard Kite from Viterbo University. He says a lot of politics in the United States are being driven by anger, and that's not a good thing for the future of the country.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the future of the country? What in particular has you concerned? And do you feel this anger that we're talking about? Or do you share his concern that anger itself is one of the biggest problems we have to worry about? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I would say that anger is a huge part of the political process right now, but I believe a lot of it is coming from the fact that the media is not doing their job. Recently, the Ben Rhodes article that in which he talked about playing the media to pass the Iran nuclear treaty, shows that people are just not doing their job and the people are not being informed correctly by the media. I mean, even NPR was implicated as taking money from a company wanting to promote the Iran treaty. I mean, we have Lois Lerner taking the fifth. We have Hillary and her staff not answering the inspector general. Why isn't the media bringing up this stuff that fuels the anger?
Charlie, thanks for bringing those points up for us. Richard, so an idea that in this case, politicians aren't being responsible, that the media aren't holding their feet to the fire, the voter left without much to work with, he's saying.
I think the media pretty much does what we want it to do, that most people look to the media, first of all, for entertainment, and that pretty much most of the information that you really want to get, you can find somewhere. And if you really want to demand that certain news organizations, for example, take a closer look at something, they're generally responsive to that. It's just that there isn't much of that demand. So I think the media kind of does what it does. I think it does make one angry sometimes when we don't get accurate information or the kind of information that we're looking for. But I don't like to blame the media as if saying that it's being irresponsible. I think it's doing just what we want it to do.
Back to our callers now with Sandy on the line in Milwaukee. Sandy, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just say that I have been a Democrat all of my life, and most of my friends are Republican. And this year, it's like if you're not a Republican, you're an enemy of the people. And I think a lot of this comes from the rhetoric from the candidates and social issues. And Bernie's slogan is revolution, and Trump's slogan is change, and everyone says Hillary is for voting for the same political stance that we have had for the past 8 years.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sandy. I want to get our guest in here. We've got a lot of other callers waiting, too. But to her first point, Sandy saying the divide between parties seems stronger. And a lot of polls bear that out, Richard. A lot less flexibility, a lot more us versus them mentality. Is that part of the problem?
There's more divisiveness. You find many more people on the two extremes, and not many people that identify themselves as centrists. That say, for example, somebody says, I'm a moderate Republican, I'm a moderate Democrat, because there is where you're able to build some political consensus and actually get practical things done. And so here, it's an interesting thing. We have people talking about they're very upset that politicians aren't really doing anything, and yet very few people identify with the center where things actually get done.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Richard Kite from Viterbo University about anger and politics, especially the politics of 2016. Back to our callers now with Lachlan in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is sort of the flip side of the first question. I was wondering, to what degree do you think that social media and social media culture impact discussion in the same way that a lot of people think that mainstream media does?
Oh, interesting. Thanks for that call. So, Richard, social media gives us a lot of opportunity to get angry with each other when we're talking politics.
Yeah, it does. It makes it possible to be very selective in the kind of media that one consumes, because, of course, you get feeds and so forth from your friends. And so the more you participate in this, in some ways, the more selective your perception becomes. And And this becomes really problematic because we, as a nation, we don't have a source of information that we all agree upon, that we can rely on and say, okay, we disagree with on say, for example, immigration statistics. What's really going on with immigration? How has it changed over the last few years? Where should we go and look for this to settle our difference about fact, about the information? Right now, we don't really have any of these kind of accepted authorities for public knowledge. And social media is in part responsible for driving this, you know, this wealth of information and kind of perspectives that causes us to lack a way to resolve differences.
Thanks for that call. Time for, I think, one more caller. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I have an idea as to why people are angry and what can be done, but it takes cooperation from everyone. First of all, I should mention I'm a Viterbo alum, and I have worked as a mediator and an arbitration, and I've also done a lot of dispute resolution for a federal agency. So I've seen a lot of anger coming from a lot of places. And recently I saw a documentary about individuals who were, I think it was caught in Katrina, and how they weren't getting their houses built, the promises that the politicians made weren't being kept. Every politician has its own little group of people they try to have endorse them. And nobody is quite honest with anyone. And I think that the people as a whole who are feeling angry, they feel so disenfranchised because they have no one to speak to, no one to listen to, no one to go to, no one to help them.
Kathy, thanks. Just about out of time, Richard, but a feeling of powerlessness and disenfranchisement, do you think that's maybe a big motivating factor in anger as we wrap up?
Yeah, I certainly do. And I think the solution is we need to have people much more involved in local politics from an early age. The more we get involved at the local level and then learn how the process works, how to get information, how to be effective, the less frustration we feel with the system as a whole.
We'll leave it there. Richard, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
We've been talking to Richard Kite. He's a professor and a director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University. We've been talking about his recent column on anger and politics. It was in the La Crosse Tribune, where he is a member of the editorial board. By the way, we've got a link to that piece. It's on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, you can share some of your answers to the questions we've been posing. Do you see more anger in politics than usual, even in a presidential election year, more than you've seen in the past? Do you think social media is driving some of that anger? What are you angry about, or are you worried about the anger you're seeing in American politics? Again, head over to the Central Time Facebook page, get a link to Richard Kite's article there, and share your thoughts, your insights on those questions. A lot of people gathered for, you know, get-togethers and grill-outs over the holiday weekend, and you might have, while out and about, encountered a case of double-dipping. You know, that's when somebody takes the dip, the chip or the carrot, they dip it in the dip, take a bite, and then, and here's the key, this is the double part, dip it again.
Well, you can see sort of the metaphysical difficulty here, right? Because you have your chip.
Mm-hmm.
You have dip, you use that dip up, and then you still got chip left. So
right.
You've got a double dip, right?
Well, easy solution, break the chip or the bread or the carrot first, dip that half.
Which
eat,
is
dip
what
half.
I
so,
do.
So this should be a non-problem, me too, but it's still out there. Now, you came across some older research. Somebody actually, is this a problem with the science on this thing?
Right, and it turns out, I guess, that there is more bacteria. When someone does double dip, there is more bacteria in it, but we don't know whether it's going to be good bacteria or bad bacteria, where we're actually going to get sick because of it or not, or whether it just grosses us out.
Yeah, as I was reading this, I first had the aha, I've been right all along response, and they said more bacteria. But bacteria, kind of a dirty word. We don't know if, you know, the sick person is giving that illness-causing bacteria to the rest of us.
Right, and gut bacteria, well, that's good. We're supposed to encourage it, right?
Right, up to a point.
So double dipping good, ergo?
Probably not. I will still avoid the double dipping. This is Central Time.